Enough. He knows when to ask questions and when to let them pass. What am I supposed to do? Look, Mr. Beebe, it's Frank. Okay, Frank. I doubt there are many black folks in and around Willow Gap. That plus I'm from Miami and I have Florida tags on my little foreign car. If I show up and start poking around, asking questions, I probably won't get too far. You'd probably get shot. I'd like to avoid that. So, I figure you can do the job without raising suspicion. I just need his address and phone number if possible. Anything else would be gravy. Have you tried the phone book? Yes, and there are quite a few coolies around Willow Gap. No, Nathan. I wouldn't get too far making a bunch of cold calls. Right. Anything else? That's it. Pretty simple. Okay. I charge $100 an hour plus expenses. I'll drive to Willow Gap this afternoon. It's about an hour from here, way back in the boondocks. So I've heard. The first draft of my letter reads, Dear Mr. Cooley, my name is Reed Baldwin, and I am a documentary filmmaker in Miami. Along with two partners, I own a production company called Skelter Films. We specialize in documentaries dealing with the abuse of power by the federal government. My current project deals with a series of cold-blooded murders carried out by agents of the Drug Enforcement Administration. This topic is very close to me because 3 years ago, my 17-year-old nephew was gunned down by two agents in Trenton, New Jersey. He was unarmed and had no criminal record. Of course, an internal investigation showed no fault on the part of the DEA. The lawsuit filed by my family was dismissed. In researching this film, I believe I have uncovered a conspiracy that reaches the highest levels of the DEA. I believe certain agents are encouraged to simply murder drug dealers or suspected drug dealers. The purpose is twofold. First, such murders obviously stop criminal activity. Second, they avoid lengthy trials and such. The DEA is killing people instead of arresting them. To date, I have uncovered about a dozen of these suspicious killings. I have interviewed several of the families, and they all feel strongly that their loved ones were murdered. This brings me to you. I know the basic facts regarding the death of your brother Gene in 2004. There were at least three DEA agents involved in the shooting, and as always, they claim they acted in self-defense. I believe you were on the scene at the time of the shooting. Please allow me the opportunity to meet, buy you lunch, and discuss this project. I am currently in Washington, D.C., but I can drop things here and drive to Southwest Virginia at your convenience. My cell phone number is 305-806-1921. Thank you for your time. Sincerely, M. Reed Baldwin. The clock slows considerably as the hours pass. I go for a long drive south down Interstate 81 and check out Blacksburg, home of Virginia Tech. Then Christiansburg, Radford, Marion, and Pulaski. It's mountainous terrain and a pretty drive, but I'm not sightseeing. I may need one of these towns in the near future, and so I take notes of truck stops, motels, and fast food joints near the interstate. The truck traffic is heavy, and there are automobiles from dozens of states, so no one notices me. Occasionally, I leave the four-lane and venture deep into the hills, driving through small towns without stopping. I find Ripplemead, population 500. the nearest hamlet to the lakeside cabin where Judge Fawcett and Naomi Clary were murdered. I eventually wander back to Roanoke. The lights are on. The Red Sox are playing again. I buy a ticket and have a hot dog and a beer for dinner. Frank Beebe calls me at 8 the next morning, and an hour later I'm in his office. As he pours coffee, he says matter-of-factly, "Found him in the town of Radford, a college town of about 16,000. He got out of prison a few months ago, lived with his mother for a while, then moved away. I talked to his mother, a tough old gal, and she said he bought a bar in Radford. I'm curious, so I ask, "How did you get her to talk?" Frank laughs and lights another cigarette. "That's the easy part, Reed. When you've been in this business as long as I have, you can always spew some bullshit and get people talking. I figured his mother still has a healthy fear of anyone connected to the prison system. So I told her I was a federal prison agent and needed to chat with her boy." "Isn't that impersonating an officer?"
"Nope. No such thing as a federal prison agent. She didn't ask for a card, and if she had, then I would have given her one. I keep a bunch of cards. On any given day, I can be one of many different federal agents. You'd be amazed how easy it is to fool people."
"Did you go to the bar?"
"I did, but I didn't go in. I wouldn't fit. It's just off the campus of Radford University, so the crowd is a lot younger than me. It's called Bombay's, and it's been around for some time. According to city records, it changed hands on May 10th of this year. The seller was one Arthur Stone, and your boy, Nathan Cooley, was the buyer."
"Where does he live?"
"Don't know. Nothing in the land records. I suspect he's renting, so there would be no record of that. Hell, he could be sleeping above the bar. It's an old two-story building."
"You're not going there, are you?"
"No."
"Good. You're too old, and you're too black. It's an all-white crowd."
"Thanks. I'll meet him somewhere else."
I pay Frank Beebe $600 in cash, and on the way out I ask,
"Say, Frank, if I needed a fake passport, you got any ideas?"
"Sure. There's a guy in Baltimore I've used before. Does most anything. But passports are tricky these days. Homeland Security and all that crap. If they catch you, they really get excited."
I smile and say, "It's not for me."
He laughs and says, "Gee, I've never heard that before."
My car is packed, and I leave town. 4 hours later, I'm in McLean, Virginia, looking for a copy center that offers executive services. I find one in an upscale shopping center, pay a hookup fee, and plug in my laptop to a printer. After 10 minutes of fiddling and haggling, I get the damn thing to work and print the letter to Nathan Cooley. It's on Skelter Films stationery, complete with an address on 8th Avenue in Miami, and a full selection of phone and fax numbers. On the envelope I write, "Mr. Nathan Cooley, care of Bombay's Bar and Grill, 914 East Main Street, Radford, Virginia, 24141. To the left of the address, I write in bold letters, "Personal and Confidential." When it's perfect, I cross the Potomac and drive through central D.C., looking for a post office drop box. Chapter 28. Quinn Rucker turned his back to the bars, stuck his hands through, and touched his wrists behind him. The deputy slapped on the handcuffs as another one opened the cell door. They escorted Quinn to a cramped holding area where three FBI agents were waiting. From there, they walked him through a side door and into a black SUV with dark windows and more armed guards. 10 minutes later, He arrived with full escort at the rear door of the federal building, where he was whisked inside and up two flights of stairs. Neither Victor Westlake, nor Stanley Mumphrey, nor any other lawyer in the room had ever taken part in such a meeting. The defendant was never brought in for a chat. If the police needed to talk to the accused, they did so at the jail. If his appearance was needed in court, the judge or magistrate called a hearing. Quinn was led into the small conference room, and the handcuffs were removed. He shook hands with his lawyer, Dusty Shiver, who, of course, had to be present, but was uncertain about the meeting. He had cautioned the feds that his client would say nothing until he, Dusty, allowed him to speak. Quinn had been in jail for 4 months and was not doing well. For reasons known only to his keepers, he was locked down in solitary confinement. Contact with his guards was minimal. The food was dreadful, and he was losing weight. He was also taking antidepressants and sleeping 15 hours a day. Often he refused to meet with anyone from his family or with Dusty. One week he demanded the right to plead guilty in exchange for life in prison. The next week he wanted a trial. He had fired Dusty twice, only to rehire him days later. He occasionally admitted killing Judge Fawcett and his girlfriend, but always recanted and accused the government of doping his food. He had threatened the guards with promises of death and the deaths of their children, only to offer tearful apologies when his mood changed. Victor Westlake was in charge of the meeting and began by saying, "Let's get to the point, Mr. Rucker. We have it on good intelligence that you and some of your fellow conspirators desire to knock off one of our witnesses." Dusty touched Quinn's arm and said, "Not a word. Do not speak until I say so." Quinn smiled at Westlake, as if killing a government witness would be a delight. Westlake kept going. "The purpose of this little get-together is to warn you, Mr. Rucker, that if any of our witnesses are harmed, then you will face additional charges, and not just you. We'll go after every member of your family." Quinn was grinning, and he blurted, "So Bannister is on the run, huh?" "Shut up, Quinn," Dusty said.
"I don't have to shut up," Quinn said. "I hear Bannister has left the warm sun of Florida."
"Shut up, Quinn," Dusty snarled again. "Got him a new face, probably a new name, the works," Quinn continued.
Stanley Mumphrey said,
"We'll indict D-Ray, Tall Man, several of your cousins, anybody and everybody we can throw the book at, Quinn, if you harm any of our witnesses."
"You don't have any witnesses," Quinn shot across the table. "Only Bannister."
Dusty threw his hands up and slumped in his chair.
"I advise you to shut up, Quinn."
"I hear you," Quinn said. "I hear you."
Westlake managed to maintain a scowl as he stared at the defendant, but he was stunned. The meeting was supposed to intimidate Quinn, not frighten the government. How on earth were they able to find Bannister in Florida and now know he had fled? It was a chilling moment for Westlake and his assistants. If they could find their informant, they would certainly bring him in.
"Your entire family could face capital murder charges," Stanley plowed on in a feeble attempt to sound tough.
Quinn just smiled. He stopped talking and folded his arms across his chest. "I have to see Vanessa Young. A meeting has an element of risk. To be seen together by the wrong people would create questions I'm not ready to answer. But a meeting is inevitable and has been for several years. I saw her at Frostburg on a snowy day when many visitors didn't make the drive. While I was talking to my father, Henry, she walked in and sat at the next table. She was there to visit her brother. She was gorgeous, early 40s, soft brown skin, beautiful sad eyes, long legs and tight jeans, the whole package. I could not keep my eyes off her, and Henry finally said,
"You want me to leave?"
Of course not, because if he left, then my visiting time was over. The longer he stayed, the longer I could look at Vanessa. Before long, she was looking back, and we were soon making serious eye contact. The attraction was mutual at first. But there were a couple of sticking points. First, my incarceration, and second, her marriage, which, as it turned out, was a mess. I leaned on her brother for information, but he wanted to stay out of it. We swapped a few letters, but she was afraid of getting caught by her husband. She tried to visit more often to see both her brother and me, but she had two teenagers who were complicating her life. After her divorce was final, she dated other men, but nothing worked. I begged Vanessa to wait for me, but 7 years is a long time when you're 41. When her kids left home, she moved to Richmond, Virginia, and our long-distance romance cooled off. Vanessa's background is such that she is extremely cautious and keeps one eye on the rearview mirror. I guess we have that much in common. Using encrypted emails, we managed to arrange a time and place. I warn her that I look nothing like the Malcolm Bannister she met in prison. She says she'll take that chance. She can't wait to see the new and improved version. As I park outside the restaurant in a suburb of Richmond, I have a bad case of the butterflies. I'm a wreck because I am about to finally touch the woman I have dreamed about for almost 3 years. I know she wants to touch me too, but the guy she was so physically attracted to back then looks entirely different now. What if she doesn't approve? What if she prefers Malcolm to Max? It's also unnerving to realize I'm about to spend time with the only person outside the feds who knows both men. I wipe perspiration from my forehead and consider leaving. Then I get out and slam the door. She's at the table, and as I almost stutter step over, she smiles. She approves. I kiss her gently on the cheek and sit down, and for a long time we just look at each other. Finally, I say,
"Well, what do you think?"
Vanessa shakes her head and says,
"Pretty astonishing. I would have never known. Got any ID?
We both laugh, and I say, "Sure, but it's all bogus. It says I'm Max now, not Malcolm."
"You look thin, Max."
"Thanks, and you too." I caught a glimpse of her legs under the table. Short skirt, funky high heels. She's dressed for action. "Which do you prefer?" I ask.
"Well, I suppose I don't have a choice now, do I?" "I think you're cute, Max. I like the new you. The whole ensemble. Whose idea was the designer eyeglasses?"
"My consultant. Same guy who suggested the slick head and 4 days of stubble."
"The more I see, the more I like."
"Thank God. I'm a nervous wreck."
"Relax, baby. We're in for a long night."
The waiter takes our drink orders, a martini for me, diet soda for her. There are a lot of things I don't want to discuss, namely my sudden exit from prison and witness protection. The brother she visited in prison got out, but is already back behind bars, so we leave him out of the conversation. I ask about her kids, a daughter who's 20 and in college, and a son who's 18 and drifting. At one point, as I'm talking, she stops me and says, "You even sound different." Good. It's a new speech pattern I've been practicing for months now. A much slower delivery and a deeper voice. Does it seem genuine?
I think so. Yes, it's working.
She asks where I'm living, and I explain I've yet to find a home. I'm moving around trying to avoid getting trailed by the FBI and others. Lots of cheap motels. I'm not a fugitive, but I'm not exactly in the clear. Our dinner arrives, but we hardly notice. She says, "You look a lot younger. Maybe I should see your plastic surgeon." Please, don't change a thing. I talk about the changes, primarily the eyes, nose, and chin. I amuse her by describing the meetings with my surgical team and our efforts to design a new face. I'm also 20 pounds lighter, and she thinks I need to put on a few pounds. As our nerves settle, we relax and talk like a couple of old friends. The waiter asks if our food is okay, since we've hardly touched it. We hit a number of topics, but in the back of our minds, we're both thinking the same thing. I finally say, "Let's get out of here." The words are barely spoken, and she's reaching for her purse. I pay cash for the meal, and we're in the parking lot. I don't like the idea of her apartment, and she agrees. It's rather small and bare, she explains. We check into a hotel I spotted down the street and order a bottle of champagne. Two kids on their wedding night could not possibly exert more energy than Vanessa and I. There was so much ground to cover. So much catching up to do. Chapter 29. While Vanessa is at work, I run a few errands around Richmond. At one store, I spend $70 on a cheap prepaid cell phone with 100 minutes of call time, and at another, I buy the identical phone and plan for $68. I give one phone to Vanessa and keep the other. At a pharmacy, I load up on prepaid credit cards. I have an appointment with a man who owns a camera shop and calls himself a videographer, but his fee is too high. If I'm lucky and get an interview, I'll need two people, a cameraman and a gopher. This guy says he works with a full crew or doesn't work at all. Vanessa and I have a sandwich for lunch in a deli not far from her office. For dinner, we go to a bistro in the Carytown section of Richmond. Our after-dinner routine is remarkably and wonderfully similar to the night before and in the same hotel room. This could be habit-forming. Our plans for the third night, though, are derailed when her son calls. He's passing through town and needs a place to stay. She figures he'll need some money, too. We're finishing dinner when the cell phone in my pocket vibrates. The caller ID says unknown, but then all calls to this phone are unknown. Expecting big news, I say to Vanessa, "Excuse me," and step away from the table. In the foyer of the restaurant, I answer the phone. A vaguely familiar voice says,
"Mr. Reed Baldwin? This is Nathan Cooley. I got your letter."
I tell myself to speak slowly and deeply. "Yes, Mr. Cooley. Thanks for the call." Of course he got my letter. How else would he have my phone number?
"When do you want to talk?"
he asks. "Anytime. I'm in Washington right now, and we finished filming today. I have some downtime, so right now is perfect. What about you?"
"I'm not going anywhere. How did you find me?"
"The internet.
It's hard to hide these days.
I guess so. I usually sleep late, then work at the bar from about 2 until midnight.
How about lunch tomorrow? I say, a bit too eagerly. Just the two of us. No cameras or recorders or stuff like that. I'm buying. A pause, and I hold my breath.
Okay, I guess. Where?
It's your neck of the woods, Mr. Cooley. You pick the time and place. I'll be there.
Okay. At the Radford exit off Interstate 81, there is a place called Spanky's. I'll meet you there at noon tomorrow.
I'll be there.
How will I recognize you?
He asks, and I almost drop my phone. Recognition is a far greater issue than he'll ever realize. I have subjected myself to surgery that radically altered my face. I shave my head every other day, and my beard once a week. I have starved off 20 pounds. I wear fake tortoiseshell glasses with round red frames, along with black t-shirts, fake Armani sport coats, and canvas sandals one would find only in Miami or LA. I have a different name. I have a different voice and delivery. And this entire charade has been carefully put together, not to mislead the people who want to follow me or kill me, but to conceal my real identity from you, Mr. Nathan Cooley. I say, I'm 6 feet tall, black, thin, a slick head, and I'll be wearing a white straw hat, Panama style.
You're black?
He blurts. Yep. Is that a problem?
No. See you tomorrow.
I return to the table where Vanessa is waiting anxiously. I say softly, it's Cooley. We're meeting tomorrow. She smiles and says,
go for it.
We finish dinner and reluctantly say goodbye. We kiss outside the restaurant and act like a couple of teenagers. I think about her all the way to Roanoke. I arrive 15 minutes early and park so that I can watch the vehicles as they turn into the Spanky's lot. The first thing I'll see is his car or truck, and this will reveal a lot. 6 months ago, he was in prison, where he had served a little over 5 years. He has no father, an alcoholic mother, and no education past the 10th grade, so his choice of vehicle will be interesting. As we talk, my plans are to make a mental note of everything I can possibly see: clothing, jewelry, watch, cell phone. The traffic picks up as the lunch crowd rolls in. At 12:03, a sparkling new silver Chevrolet Silverado half-ton pickup arrives, and I suspect it's Nathan Cooley. It is, and he parks on the other side of the lot. He glances around nervously as he walks to the front entrance. It's been 4 years since I've seen him, and he appears to have changed little. Same weight, same blonde shaggy hair, though he once shaved his head in prison. He looks twice at the Florida tags on my car, then goes inside. I take a deep breath, put the Panama hat on my head, and walk to the door. Be cool, you idiot, I mumble to myself as my bowels flip. This will take a steady hand and nerves of steel. We meet inside the front foyer and exchange pleasantries. I remove the hat as we follow the hostess to a booth in the rear. Across the table, we face each other and talk about the weather. For a moment, I'm almost overwhelmed by my ruse. Nathan is talking to a stranger, while I'm talking to a kid I once knew quite well. He doesn't seem at all suspicious. No staring at my eyes or nose, no squinting or raised eyebrows or distant glances as he listens to my voice. And thankfully, no, you kind of remind me of a guy I once knew. Nothing. so far. I tell the waitress I really want a beer, a tall draft, and Nathan hesitates before saying,
"The same."
The success of this long-shot mission could well depend on alcohol. Nathan was raised in a culture of hard drinking and meth addiction. Then he spent 5 years in prison, clean and sober. I'm assuming he's back to his old habits now that he's out. The fact that he owns his own bar is a good indication. For a hillbilly who was never taught how to dress, he looks okay. Washed jeans, a Coors Light golf shirt some salesman left at the bar, and combat boots. There is no jewelry and no watch, but he does have an incredibly ugly prison tattoo inside his left forearm. In short, Nathan is not flashing around money with his appearance. The beer arrives and we tap glasses.
"Tell me about this film," he says.
Out of habit, I nod, pause, tell myself to speak slowly, clearly, and as deeply as possible. "I've been making documentaries for 10 years now, and this is the most exciting project I've seen."
"Look, Mr. Baldwin, what is a documentary film exactly? I watch some movies and all, but I don't think I've seen too many documentaries."
"Sure. They're typically small, independently produced films that you don't see in the big movie houses. They're not commercial. They're about real people, real problems, real issues. No big movie stars and all that. Really good stuff. The best win awards at film festivals and get some attention, but they're never going to make a lot of money. My company specializes in films that deal with the abuse of power, primarily by the federal government, but also by big corporations." I take a sip, tell myself to go slow. "Most are about an hour long. This one might run for 90 minutes, but we'll decide that later." The waitress is back. I order a chicken sandwich and Nathan wants a basket of wings. "How'd you get into the bar business?" I ask. He takes a gulp, smiles, says,
"Friend, the guy who owned the bar was going under. Not from the bar, but from other properties. Recession got him, I think. So he was trying to unload Bombay's. He was looking for some fool to take the deed and assume the debts. And I said, what the hell? I'm only 30. No job, no prospects. Why not take a chance? So far, though, I'm making money. It's kind of fun. Lots of college girls hanging around."
"You're not married?"
"No. Don't know how much you know about me, Mr. Baldwin, but I just finished a 5-year prison sentence. Thanks to the federal government, I ain't had too many dates recently. Just now getting back in the game. Know what I mean?"
"Sure. The prison time arose out of the same incident in which your brother was killed, right?"
"You got it. I pled guilty and went away for 5. My cousin is still in prison, Big Sandy over in Kentucky, a bad place. Most of my cousins are either locked up or dead. That's one reason I moved to Radford, Mr. Baldwin, to get away from the drug business."
"I see. Please call me Reed. My father is Mr. Baldwin."
"Okay, and I'm Nathan, or Nate."
We tap glasses again as if we're suddenly much closer. In prison, we call them Natty.
"Tell me about your film company," he says.
I anticipated this, but it is still shaky ground. I take a gulp and swallow slowly. "Skelter is a new company based in Miami. Just me and 2 partners, plus a staff. For years, I worked for a bigger production company in L.A., an outfit called Cove Creek Films. You may have heard of it." He has not. He just glanced at the rear end of a shapely young waitress. "Anyway,
Cove Creek has won a ton of awards and made decent money in this business. But last year it blew up. Big fight over creative control and which projects to do next. We're still in the middle of some nasty litigation that looks like it will drag on for years. There's an injunction in federal court in L.A. that prohibits me from even talking about Cove Creek or the lawsuit. Pretty crazy, huh? To my relief, Nathan is rapidly losing interest in my film company and its problems.
Why are you based in Miami?
I went there a few years ago working on a film about bogus government defense contractors and fell in love with the place. I live on South Beach. Ever been there?
No.
Except for the trips arranged by the U.S. Marshals Service, Nathan has never ventured more than 200 miles from Willow Gap. It's a happening place. Beautiful beaches, gorgeous girls, wild nightlife. I got a divorce 4 years ago, and I'm enjoying the single life again. I spend about half the year there. The other half I'm on the road filming.
How do you film a documentary?
He asks, then knocks back some beer. It's far different from a feature film. It's usually just me and a cameraman, maybe a technician or two. The story is the important part, not the scenery or the actor's face.
And you want to film me?
Absolutely. You, maybe your mother, maybe other members of the family. I want to go to the place where your brother was killed. What I'm after here, Nathan, is the truth. I'm onto something. Something that could really be big. If I can prove the DEA systematically knocks off drug dealers, that they murder them in cold blood, then we might be able to bust these some bitches. My nephew was breaking bad, getting deeper into the crack trade. But he was not a hardcore dealer. Stupid, yes, but not dangerous. He was 17 and unarmed, and he was shot 3 times from point-blank range. A stolen pistol was left at the scene, and the DEA claims it belonged to him. They're a bunch of liars. Nathan's face slowly contorts into anger, and he looks as if he wants to spit. I press on. The film will be the story of 3, maybe 4 of these murders. I'm not sure if my nephews will be included because I'm the filmmaker. Maybe I'm too close to his death. I've already filmed the story of Jose Alvarez in Amarillo, Texas, a 19-year-old undocumented worker who was shot 14 times by DEA agents. Problem is, no one in his family speaks English, and there's not much sympathy for illegal immigrants. I filmed the story of Tyler Marshak, a college boy in California who was peddling marijuana. The DEA broke into his dorm room like a bunch of Gestapo goons and shot him dead in his bed. You may have read about it. He is not. The Nathan Cooley I knew played video games hours a day and never looked at a newspaper or magazine. Nor does he have the innate curiosity to check out either Skelter Films or Cove Creek. Anyway, I have some great footage of the dorm room, the autopsy, and statements from his family, but they're currently tied up in a lawsuit against the DEA. I may not be able to use this. Lunch arrives and we order more beer. Nathan rips chicken off the bone and wipes his mouth with a napkin.
Why are you so interested in my brother's case?
Let's say I'm curious. I don't know all the facts yet. I would like to hear your version of what happened and walk through the drug bust at the scene. My lawyers have filed Freedom of Information applications to get the DEA records and also the court file. We'll plow through the paperwork, but there's a good chance the DEA has covered up everything. That's what they typically do. We will slowly piece things together, and at the same time, we'll see how you and your family look on camera. The camera doesn't like everyone, Nathan. He says,
I doubt if the camera likes my mother.
We'll see.
Not so sure about that. She probably won't do it. You mention anything about Jean's death, and she falls all to pieces.
He licks his fingers and selects another wing. Perfect. That's what I want to capture on film.
What's the time frame here? What are we looking at?
I take a bite of my sandwich and chew for a while as I ponder. Maybe a year? I'd like to finish all the filming within the next 6 months, then have that much time to cut, splice, edit, maybe reshoot some stuff. You can tinker with these things forever, and it's hard to let go. As far as you're concerned, I would like to shoot some initial footage, maybe 3 or 4 hours, and send that to my producers and editors in Miami. Let them see you, hear you, get a feel for the story and your ability to tell it. If we all agree, then we'll keep shooting.
What's in it for me?
Nothing. Other than the truth and exposing the men who killed your brother. Think about it, Nathan. Wouldn't you love to see these bastards charged with murder and put on trial?
Damn right I would.
I lean in fiercely, my eyes on fire. Then do it, Nathan. Tell me his story. You have nothing to lose and a lot to gain. Tell me about the drug trade, how it wrecked your family, how Jean got caught up in it, how it was simply a way of life in these parts. There were no other jobs. You don't have to name names. I don't want to get anyone in trouble. I take a sip and finish off my second beer. Where was Jean the last time you saw him?
Lying on the ground, hands behind his back, getting handcuffed. Not a single shot had been fired by anyone. The deal was gone. The bust was over. I was handcuffed and led away. Then I heard gunshots. They said Jean tripped an agent and sprinted into the woods. Bullshit. They killed him in cold blood.
You gotta tell me this story, Nathan. You gotta take me back to the scene and reenact it. The world needs to know what the federal government is doing in its war on drugs. It's taking no prisoners. He takes a deep breath to let the moment pass. I'm talking too much and too fast, so I spend a few minutes with my sandwich. The waitress asks if we want another round. Yes, please, for me, I say, and Nathan quickly follows. He finishes off a wing, licks his fingers, and says,
My family is causing problems right now. That's why I moved away and came to Radford.
I shrug as if this is his problem, not mine. But I'm not surprised. I ask, If you cooperate and the rest of your family does not, will that cause more trouble? He laughs and says,
Trouble is the norm with the coolies. We are notorious for feuding.
Let's do this. Let's sign a 1-page agreement, already prepared by my lawyers and in English so plain you don't need to hire your own lawyers unless you enjoy pissing away money. And the agreement will state that you, Nathan Cooley, will cooperate fully in the making of this documentary film. In return, you'll be paid a fee of $8,000, which is the minimum required of actors in these projects. From time to time, or whenever you want, you can review the film in progress. And this is crucial, if you don't like what you see, you can walk, and I cannot use any of your footage. That's a pretty fair deal, Nathan. He nods as he searches for loopholes. But Nathan is not the type to analyze things quickly. Plus, the alcohol is urging him on. I suspect he's drooling over the word actor.
$8,000?
He repeats. Yes, as I said, these are low-budget films. Nobody will make a lot of money. The interesting point here is that I mentioned money before he did.
I sweeten the deal by adding, "Plus, you'll get a small piece of the back end." A piece of the back end. Nathan is probably thinking of something else. That means you'll get a few bucks if the movie sells some tickets, but don't expect it, I say. You're not doing this for the money, Nathan. You're doing it for your brother. The plate in front of him is littered with bones. The waitress brings our third round and removes the scraps. It's important to keep him talking because I don't want him thinking. What kind of guy was Gene? I ask. He shakes his head and looks as if he might cry.
My big brother, you know. Our dad disappeared when we were small. Just me and Gene.
He narrates a few stories about their childhood, funny stories about two kids trying to survive. We finish our third beers, order another round, but vow to stop after that. At 10 the following morning, Nathan and I meet at a coffee shop in Radford. He looks over the contract, asks a few questions, and signs it. I sign as the vice president of Skelter Films and hand over a check for $8,000 drawn on a company bank account in Miami.
When do we start? He asks.
Well, Nathan, I'm here and I'm not leaving. The sooner the better. What about tomorrow morning?
Sure. Where?
I've been thinking about that. We're in Southwest Virginia, where mountains are important. In fact, the land here has a lot to do with the story. The remoteness of the mountains and so on. I think I like to be outdoors. At first, anyway. We can always move around. Do you live in town or in the country?
I'm renting a place just outside town. From the backyard, there's a nice view of some hills.
Let's take a look. I'll be there at 10 in the morning with a small crew, and we'll check out the lighting.
Okay. I talked to my mother, and she says no way.
Can I talk to her?
You can try, but she's pretty tough. She doesn't like the idea of you or anybody else making a movie about Gene and our family. She thinks you'll make us look like a bunch of ignorant mountain folk.
Did you explain that you have the right to monitor the film as it progresses?
I tried to. She was drinking.
Sorry.
I'll see you in the morning.
Chapter 30. Nathan is living in a small red brick house on a narrow road, a few miles west of the Radford city limits. His nearest neighbor lives in a double-wide trailer, half a mile closer to the state highway. His front lawn is neatly mowed, and there are a few shrubs lining the narrow front porch. He's outside playing with his yellow lab as we arrive and park in the drive behind his shiny new truck. My ace crew consists of my new assistant, Vanessa, who will be called Gwen on this project, and two freelancers from Roanoke, Slade, the videographer, and his assistant, Cody. Slade bills himself as a filmmaker and works out of his garage. He owns the cameras and equipment, and he looks the part. Long hair and a ponytail, jeans with holes in the knees, a couple of gold chains around his neck. Cody is younger and sufficiently grungy. Their fee is $1,000 a day plus expenses, and part of the deal is that they do what they're supposed to do and stay as quiet as possible. I have promised to pay them in cash, and I've made no reference to Skelter Films or anything else. It might be a documentary film, or it might be something else. Just do as I say and offer no details to Nathan Cooley. Vanessa arrived in Radford last night, and we bunked together in a nice hotel where we registered in her name and used a prepaid credit card. She told her boss she had the flu and, under doctor's orders, can't leave the house for several days. She knows nothing about filmmaking, but then neither do I. After a round of awkward introductions in the driveway, we check out the surroundings. Nathan's backyard is a large open area that slopes up the side of a hill. A herd of white-tailed deer scamper over a fence when they see us. I ask Nathan how long it takes to cut his grass, and he says 3 hours. He points to a tractor shed where a fancy John Deere riding mower is parked. It looks new. He says he's a country boy who prefers the outdoors, likes to hunt and fish and pee off the back porch. Plus, he still thinks of prison and life there with 1,000 men surviving in close quarters. No, sir. He loves the open spaces. While we walk and talk, Slade and Cody wander aimlessly about, mumbling to each other as they look at the sun and rub their chins. I like it here, I say, pointing, taking charge. I want those hills in the frame. Slade seems to disagree, but he and Cody nonetheless start hauling gear from their van. The setup takes forever, and to show my artistic temperament, I start barking about the time. Gwen has brought along a small makeup kit, and Nathan reluctantly agrees to a touch-up with powder and a bit of blush. I'm sure it's his first, but he needs to feel like an actor. Gwen is wearing a short skirt and a blouse that's hardly buttoned, and part of her act is to see how easily the boy can be teased. I pretend to look over my notes, but I watch Nathan as he watches Gwen. He loves the attention and teasing. When the camera, lights, monitor, and sound are almost ready, I take Nathan aside, just the two of us, director and star, to contemplate my vision. Okay, Nathan, I want you to be very serious. Think about Gene, his murder at the hands of the federal government. I want you to be somber. No smiles. No fun here, okay? Got it. Speak slowly, almost painfully. I'll ask the questions. You look at the camera and just talk. Act naturally. You're a nice-looking guy, and I think the camera will like you. But it's important to just be yourself. I'll try, he says, and it's obvious Nathan is really looking forward to this. One last thing, and I should have mentioned it yesterday. If this film does what we hope and blows the cover off the DEA, then there could be some retribution, some payback. I don't trust the DEA for 1 second, a bunch of rogue thugs, and they might do anything. That's why it's important for you to be, shall we say, out of the business.
I'm clean, man, he says.
You're not dealing in any way.
Hell no. I'm not going back to prison, Reed. That's one reason I moved over here, away from my family. They're still cooking meth and selling it. Not me.
Okay. Just think of Gene. Cody puts the mic on him, and we get situated. We're on a set in folding chairs with lights and wiring all around us. The camera is over my shoulder, and for a moment I feel like a real kick-ass investigative journalist. I look at Gwen and say, did you forget the still shots?
Come on, Gwen!
She jumps as I bark and grabs a camera. I say, just a couple of stills, Nathan, so we'll have a clear record of the lighting. He frowns at first, then smiles at Gwen as she snaps away. Finally, after we've been here for an hour, we start filming. I hold a pen with my left hand and scribble on a legal pad. Malcolm Bannister was right-handed, just in case Nathan might be suspicious, which he does not seem to be. To loosen him up, I start with all the basics: name, age, employment, education, prison, criminal record, children, no marriages, and so on. A couple of times I tell him to relax, repeat something, we're just having a conversation. His childhood, different homes, schools, life with his big brother Gene, no father, a rocky relationship with his mother. At this point, he says, look, Reed, I'm not going to say bad things about my mother.
okay?
Of course not, Nathan. That's not at all what I intended. And I quickly changed the subject. We get around to the meth culture of his youth. With some hesitation, he finally opens up and paints a depressing picture of a rough adolescence filled with drugs, booze, sex, and violence. By the time he was 15, he knew how to cook meth. Two of his cousins were burned alive when a lab blew up in a mobile home. He was 16 when he first saw the inside of a jail cell. He dropped out of school, and life got crazier. At least four of his cousins have served time for drug distribution. Two are still locked away. As bad as prison was, it did get him away from the drugs and alcohol. He was sober for the 5 years he was incarcerated, and is now determined to stay away from the meth. Beer is another matter. We break at noon. The sun is overhead, and Slade is concerned about the brightness of the conditions. He and Cody stroll around, looking for another spot.
How long can you go today, Nathan? I ask.
I'm the boss, he says smugly. I can go in whenever I want.
Great. So a couple more hours?
Why not? How am I doing?
Terrific. It took you a few minutes to settle down, but now you're very smooth, very sincere.
Gwen adds, you're a natural storyteller, Nathan.
He likes this. She's back with the makeup routine, wiping perspiration from his forehead, brushing, touching, flirting, revealing. He craves the attention. We brought sandwiches and soft drinks and eat under the shade of an oak tree next to the tool shed. Slade likes this spot, and we decide to move the set. Gwen whispers to Nathan about using the restroom. This makes him uncomfortable, but by now he can hardly keep his eyes off her legs. I walk away and pretend to be on the cell phone, talking to important people in Los Angeles. Gwen disappears into the back door of the house. She will later report that the house has two bedrooms, but only one with furniture. Nothing in the den but a sofa, a chair, and a huge HD television. One bathroom in need of a good scrubbing, a kitchen with a sink full of dirty dishes, and a refrigerator filled with beer and cold cuts. There is an attic with a fold-down staircase. The floors are covered with cheap carpeting. There are three doors, front, back, and garage, and all three are secured with thick deadbolts that have obviously been added recently. There appears to be no alarm system, no keypads or sensors over the windows and doors. In his bedroom closet, there are two rifles and two shotguns. In the closet in the spare bedroom, there is nothing but a pair of muddy hunting boots. While she is inside, I continue my fake phone chat while I watch Nathan from behind large sunglasses. He keeps his eyes on the back of his house, nervous that she is inside, alone. Slade and Cody are getting the set rewired. When she returns, Nathan relaxes and apologizes for his sloppy housekeeping. She coos and works on his hair. When everything is in place, we plunge into the afternoon session. He mentions a motorcycle accident when he was 14, and I dissect this for half an hour. We delve into his sketchy employment history, bosses, co-workers, duties, wages, dismissals. Back to the drug trade with details about how to cook meth, who taught him, key ingredients, and so on. Romances, girlfriends. He claims to have impregnated a young cousin when he was 20, but has no idea what happened to the mother or child. He had a serious girl before he went to prison, but she forgot about him. Judging by the way he looks at Gwen, it's obvious this boy is wired. He's 30 years old, and other than the death of his brother and a prison sentence, his life has been unremarkable. After 3 hours of prodding and poking, I extract anything and everything of interest. He says he needs to get to work.
We have to visit the place where Jean was killed, I say, as Slade turns off the camera and everybody relaxes.
It's outside of Bluefield, about an hour from here, he says.
Bluefield, West Virginia?
That's right.
And why were you there?
We were making a delivery, but the buyer was an informant.
I have to see this, Nathan, to walk through it all, to recapture the scene, the violence, the moment, the place where Jean was shot and killed. It was at night, right?
Yeah, long after midnight.
Gwen is tapping his face with a cloth, removing the makeup.
You're really good on camera,
she says softly, and he smiles. When can we go there? I ask. He shrugs and says,
whenever. Tomorrow if you want.
Perfect. We agree to meet at his house at 9 a.m. and caravan through the mountains into West Virginia to the remote, abandoned mine site where the Cooley brothers walked into a trap. We've had a good day with Nathan. He and I got on well as filmmaker and actor, and at times he and Gwen seemed ready to strip and have a go. Late in the afternoon, she and I find our way to Bombay's on Main Street in Radford, next to the college campus, and take a table by the dartboard. It's far too early for the college crowd, though a few rowdies are at the bar enjoying happy hour discounts. I ask the waitress to inform Nathan Cooley that we are having a drink, and within seconds he appears with a big smile. We invite him to have a seat, which he does, and we start downing beers. Gwen drinks little and manages to sip on a glass of wine while Nathan and I knock back a few pints. Coeds straggle in, and the place gets louder. I ask about specials, and there's an oyster po' boy on the chalkboard. We order two, and Nathan disappears to yell at the cook. We have dinner and stay until after dark. Not only are we the only blacks in the bar, but we are also the only patrons over the age of 22. Nathan stops by occasionally to check on us, but he's a busy man. Chapter 31. At 9 the following morning, we return to Nathan's house, and once again he's in the front yard playing with his dog, waiting. I am assuming he meets us outside because he doesn't want us inside. I explain that my little Audi is in bad need of service, and it might be best if we could ride over in his pickup. An hour each way will give us 2 hours alone with Nathan and no distractions. He shrugs and says, okay, whatever, and away we go, with Slade and Cody following in their van. I'm in the front seat. Gwen is folded into the back seat of the club cab. She's wearing jeans today because Nathan couldn't keep his eyes off her legs yesterday. She will be a bit more aloof, just to keep him guessing. As we head west toward the mountains, I admire the interior of the truck and explain that I've never spent much time in such vehicles. The seats are leather. There is an advanced GPS system and so on. Nathan is really proud of the truck and chatters on about it.